everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our theme for today, Yemen and American participation in the genocide there. You'll be hearing from individuals, including John Perkins, on the Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Why do we go into countries? How do we go in? Who do we send in? What do we say when the people are meeting with the presidents and rulers of countries in order to convince them that they should turn over their country's private assets to us in privatization programs, or we simply send in the jackals and kill them? I'll give you specific instances of America's intervening in an imperial way based upon the idea that we can do anything we want at any time to anyone, and how we have done this, where we have done it, when, and what were the circumstances. I'll focus on a few individuals specifically, and also share some information from some of the finest investigative journalists on the planet, including the reporters for Telesur about WikiLeaks releasing new Yemen files. Because if you ask the average American, where's Yemen? They have no idea. No idea that it's the bottom part and the poorest part of Saudi Arabia. They have no idea that there is genocide occurring there, all with the participation of the United States by arming with the gunships and the jets and the bombs and supporting the troops. Thousands have been killed. At least 10,000, mainly civilians, have been killed. More than 3 million have been displaced in the conflict. And one of the worst cases of famine, homelessness, and death by starvation is occurring on the entire planet, equaling or surpassing that which is occurring in some of the poorest nations in Africa. We bear full responsibility, along with the most corrupt, vile, evil group of individuals on the planet, and that is the Saudi royal family. In full support of this is the United Kingdom and those people such as Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and the people who preceded them. It's important that we know these things and then decide what should be the course of the future. Let us begin by taking a look at Telesur and some of the latest information. Here's what they say. The whistleblowing organization WikiLeaks has dropped yet another batch of files, this time detailing evidence of the United States arming, training, and financing Yemeni forces in the build-up to the current war. The so-called Yemen files appears to show how the Yemeni government received military hardware from the United States, including aircraft, vehicles and vessels, as well as the Yemeni procurement of the U.S. biometric system. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange said that in the rarely reported conflict, quote, the United States government has provided most of the bombs and is deeply involved in the conduct of the war itself, in a statement on the organization's website. Now, the latest leak of more than 500 documents from the U.S. Embassy in Yemen's communications covers both Hillary Clinton and John Kerry's time as Secretary of State from 2009 until March 2015, when the current conflict broke out. The embassy, based in the capital Sana'a, closed only a month beforehand. With U.S. backing, the Saudi Arabia-led coalition has been fighting Yemen's Houthi movement since March 2015. It wants to restore its ally president, Rabo Mansour Hadi, who was driven into exile by Houthi forces in late 2014. Now, WikiLeaks said the war in Yemen was largely strategic, with the country sitting on an important narrow choke of point for oil trade passing through the Middle East. Quote, Saudi Arabia seeks to control a port in Yemen to avoid the potential constriction of its oil shipments by Iran along the Straits of Hormuz, or by countries which can control its other oil shipment path along the Red Sea, end quote. The new leak sheds further light on what many experts and human rights advocates argue, that the coalition is committing war crimes against humanity, using U.S.-made weapons, and internal warnings have stated that the U.S. would almost certainly be accused of committing war crimes in the conflict through providing logistical and intelligence support to the Saudi-led coalition. Since 2009, President Obama has made 42 separate weapons deals with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, totaling $115 billion. That's according to a report from the Center for International Policy. The U.S. has also confirmed that it had previously sold white phosphorus, which is banned, a napalm-like chemical, to the Saudis. Recently, Yemeni citizens have been increasingly targeted by Saudi oil air raids. The UN says that more than 10,000 people minimally have been killed, most of them civilians, and the U.S. previously said it would, quote, review its support for the Saudi regime after U.S.-backed Saudi-led airstrike killed more than 140 individuals, injuring 500 more, all just innocent civilians attending a funeral. No one was held accountable. It's simply acceptable collateral damage. Despite internal warnings that U.S. weapons would almost certainly be used to commit war crimes against Yemeni civilians, the Obama administration has approved $1.3 billion in arms sales to Saudi just in the last year. And on Wednesday, at least 12 Yemeni civilians were killed after Saudi Arabia refused to extend a two-day ceasefire. So that gives you an idea of why the Saudi Arabia, that has the worst human rights record in the world, why do they do this? Well, simply because they can. They behead gays. They throw them off buildings. They beat and stone women. If you are a woman and you are raped against your will, you're raped in Saudi Arabia, you, the victim, will be lashed, frequently beaten to death with the skin on your back ripped off. That is the kind of perversion of the religion that the Saudi royal family throwbacks to a earlier primordial time where there is no respect for women. They're simply breeding machines. They have no rights. And you can be put to death for any number of reasons. In fact, more people have been beheaded this year in Saudi Arabia than ISIS has beheaded people this year. And yet they, at the encouragement of John Kerry, were selected to head the UN panel on human rights. And not a word out of the mainstream media, nor Hillary Clinton, who received millions of dollars through her foundation and to her personally and to her husband. And yet she claims she supports women's rights. What about the women of Yemen? What about the women of Saudi Arabia? What about the women in Qatar or the United Arab Emirates? What about those women? What about the women today, thousands dead and children of those women dead in one of the worst tragedies in modern history, and that is the destruction, the intentional, willful destruction of what had been the most progressive, the most prosperous, the best educated, the longest lived, the healthiest citizens of all the countries of Africa under Gaddafi in Libya. Gaddafi represented no threat whatsoever by supporting terrorism. In fact, he was one of the leading allies of challenging terrorism. That was Hillary Clinton, with the full knowledge of Bill Clinton, with the full support of Obama, and with NATO and all of the American U.S. intelligence agencies, including the CIA. So when I personally hear that people are supporting Hillary Clinton, and that is the League of Dysfunctional Democrats and the enormous cult of corporate liberals lacking humanistic values, I then suggest that if you support Hillary Clinton and you believe that she is the best representative for our country, then did you also support all of these actions around the world? Because you cannot separate the woman from her actions and her history. And if that's what you support, then we are very fortunate she did not win. But it gets worse. I want to show you now that the U.S. and its hidden hand, those people who are the deep state, the people who control our policies, do so for ideological, political, and economic reasons. Take a look at the Carnegie Mellon University study. It showed that between 1946 and 2000, the United States interfered in 81 national democratic elections in other countries. 59% of those interventions succeeded, and dictators, military juntas, and people supporting our neoliberal, corporate, and hegemony interest prevailed. What happened also in these, including Hillary Clinton's backing of the Honduras coup, which overthrew a democratically elected populist president, in its place put a man that she supported and the CIA funded and the American media, including the New York Times, was complicit in propagandizing the fake news, that then turned around and let loose an enormous amount of paramilitary forces that raped and murdered union leaders, women, all women activists in Honduras were targeted, and the leading ones were assassinated. The destruction of all human rights, and what had been a president that was promising land reform, there was no land reform. Just continuing a long legacy of turning over to the corporate interest the assets of the country for privatization and exploitation. That is the only a legacy that the Clintons and Obamas have allowed the world. It gets worse. The U.S. intervention in Russia goes back to Woodrow Wilson's administration when he included the Soviet Union in his maritime blockade of Germany in 1918. He sent thousands of U.S. troops under General Graves to the Russian port to try to retake Russia. In Italy in 1948, the U.S. threw the entire kitchen sink into getting the Italian Democratic Party to defeat the Communist Party, and they succeeded, including planting bombs, causing terrorist attacks, false flags, and then blaming it upon the Communists. The U.S. intervention in Syria actually goes back to 1949, when Syria became an independent republic under civilian rule. The CIA supported a coup by the Army Chief of Staff Zain to end civilian rule. Once in power, this U.S. asset, the CIA asset, Zain, conceded power to the U.S. for transport of oil and signed an armistice with Israel. In Iran in 1953, it is well known and fully documented that the CIA led a staged coup to oust the very peaceful Prime Minister Mossadegh, who decreed policies to nationalize the country's oil and threaten profits of British Petroleum. At that point, British Petroleum met with the Prime Minister of Great Britain and, along with Winston Churchill, convinced Eisenhower that the CIA should become involved, which it did. The U.S. media declared Mossadegh a dictator. He was not. And made him seem evil. He was not. He was a quiet, soft-spoken pacifist, and he was a scholar. And they could not find anything against him that was legitimate. So the New York Times and other publications, typical of how corrupt they are, demonized him, as they did Gaddafi. Guatemala, 1954, the CIA involved in deposing President Jacobo Arbenz and installing a military dictatorship that protected the interests of United Fruit, all because the Dulles brothers, two of the most corrupt, vile, evil human beings in American politics, one Secretary of State, the other Director of the CIA, were behind this. From 1955 to 1970, the CIA supported Tibetan insurgency to destabilize China's control over the country. The Dalai Lama has said publicly, quote, "The CIA supported the Tibetan independent movement not because the CIA cared about the Tibetan independence, but as part of their worldwide efforts to destabilize all communist governments." Repeatedly since 1959, the U.S. and the CIA and the Pentagon have attempted to overthrow the Castro regime in Cuba. In 1963, we had the debacle of Vietnam. More than 3.5 million people killed. No reparations, no apology, plus a deadly legacy, both to the nearly 3 million American vets who served during, until that point, America's longest war, more than 10 years, nor the civilians of Vietnam, with the agent defoliant 245T, Agent Orange, which they denied was toxic. Subsequent, it was shown that they knew it was toxic, but did not want to compensate the millions of vets. And I helped lead the effort with Paul Rudersham. We did more than 100 broadcasts and several major articles and demonstrations in support of the Vietnam veterans. And finally, belatedly, without acknowledging guilt, they gave a tiny little $2 billion fund for more than 3 million vets to compensate them. Too little, too late. But the U.S.-backed coup by South Vietnamese military officers against President Dinh Diem, by JFK. John F. Kennedy was a fascist at that time. His brother also participated, and they were both part of that very corrupt group. Now, the brother would later become a populist. He would have a change of heart. He would see the light, and for that, he was assassinated, as was his brother later on. But at that point, JFK supported the sham elections that allowed Diem to win by 98% of the vote so the U.S. could tout the regime as being democratically elected and the will of the people. But let us go to one of the greatest genocides in history. More than 5 million people died between 1960 and 65 in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Patricia Lumumba was democratically elected as the country's first prime minister after gaining freedom from Belgium colonialism, under which that Belgium dictator caused 10 million people living in the Congo, which was nothing more than his large plantation, King Leopold, to be murdered. The CIA supported Belgian business interests, and with hundreds of European mercenaries, and supported Joseph Mobutu, who was a total maniac and a genocidalist, and they seized power in the revolt. I should say that from 1960 to 2010, there were 5 million minimally killed in the Congo. In Iraq, from 1960 to 63, for a brief period, it was ruled as a dictator in Iraq, and this was followed by the CIA special operations to stage a coup, which led to the dictator being thrown out, Qasem, and he was executed, and the U.S. Supporting the Ba'athist Party, who came into power, and eventually they, the CIA, put Saddam Hussein in power. Never admitted that later, but it's a historical fact. In Brazil in 1964, the democratically elected president, Goulart, was overthrown in a U.S.-backed military coup under President Johnson. In Chile, from 1970 to 73, the famous case of the democratically elected Marxist president Salvador Allende being overthrown by the U.S.-backed Augusto Pinochet, which led to his tyrannical rule and a murder spree of Chilean, all of their intellectuals, all of their union leaders, their artists, their thinkers, those who believed in freedom. They were either disappeared, murdered, or imprisoned. Who was behind all this? Who was the architect? The man still alive today, and he should be in prison for life, and that is Henry Kissinger. In Turkey, in 1980, the U.S. created the CIA-backed Turkish-American Defense Council. It was founded by Richard Perle. It was organized, and it staged a military coup. In Poland, in 1980, the U.S. supported base on CIA intelligence of the Solidarity Movement. In Haiti in 1986, intelligence support for the repressive and terrorist Duvalier clan after Baby Doc was ousted by the people and Aristide, a priest, was elected. The U.S. has always been an enemy of liberation theology and its proponents in Latin America and the Caribbean. But Aristide believed in liberation theology, so they had to get rid of him, and the Clintons were behind that. In Nicaragua, In 1990, U.S. support and CIA interference against the Sandinista, Daniel Ortega. In Czechoslovakia in 1990, U.S. involvement with the Havels and the Velvet Revolution against the Communist Party in power. In Russia in 1996, the Clintons gave ongoing support to keep Yeltsin in office against his opponents and to keep the Russian economy flailing so it could be exploited. To show you how maniacal they were, Bill Clinton, along with Hillary Clinton, gave a $10 billion loan through the International Monetary Fund, focused solely on privatization and trade liberalization to destroy the Russian economy. To give you an idea of how bad it was, the average Russian is no different than the average American or the average French or British citizen. They simply want to live in peace. Only a small group of people were the elites and corrupt who ran the Communist Party, about 3 to 4 million. They never had to wait for long hours in queues getting bread or whatever might be available in the state-sponsored stores. Clearly, communism was a failed and tyrannical regime for a long period of time. But at least they had free education and free rent, and you were guaranteed work. When the privatization occurred at the end of the Russian Empire, after more than 67 years, there was no plans put in place that would help the average person. So as a result, you now had to pay for your own rent, you had to pay for food, you had to pay for everything, medical care, education, and people didn't have that money. They were poor to begin with. But people came in, including Larry Summers and others, and they took advantage. Working with people, and almost all the people in Russia in those positions, were corrupt, and that's how the oligarchs became powerful. How do I know all this? Because I was given the opportunity to meet with one of the most influential people in the Soviet Union, and he told me this. I attended an all-day conference on the island of right off the coast of Florida in the Bahamas, and there were 22 of the world's leading financial planners and the people who held the money and invested for wealthy people all over the world, financial managers, and one of them was for the oligarchs. And we had a very frank conversation about how they made their money and how bad these people are. They are today, they were then. The U.S. was also supportive of many of these people because it served their interests as well. What about the Russian people? How did they fare after the darling of the left? A little shrine should be built for George Soros because he is beloved by so many people who simply don't look deeply enough at the man and how he made his money, like shorting the Russian ruble, which threw poor people into absolute chaos. How many starved because of that? No one cares. As long as he made his money and spreads it around, then he's not to be criticized on the left. Unfortunate, he should be. Venezuela in 2002, Bush Jr., backed a coup by the aristocratic Venezuela families against Hugo Chavez. In Gaza Strip, 2006 to the present, Hamas won fair democratic elections, but the U.S. has continuously attempted to overthrow it. By the way, Hamas was originally a moderate and small Palestinian organization that was supported by the Israeli intelligence community. It was created by Israeli intelligence to create a wedge, a division in the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, and then their plan backfired. In Honduras, 2009, Hillary Clinton defended her stance on regime change in Honduras, forcing socialist and populist-elected Manuel Zelaya into exile in a military coup. The UN condemned the regime change, as did many other countries in the world, but you wouldn't know that there was a problem based upon the Washington Post, New York Times, CNN. No, they parroted exactly what they were told to. Then Paraguay in 2012, the U.S. meddled with conservative right-wing party to have democratically elected socialist Lugo impeached. In the Ukraine in 2014, Obama had admitted the U.S. brokered a deal with an anti-Russian party, which were neo-fascists. These are out-and-out Nazis, to oust democratically elected pro-Russian president Viktor Yanukovych. But there were other attempts by the CIA and U.S.-backed coups and revolutions that were successful. Guatemala, 1954. British Guiana, 1953-64. Cambodia, 1955-1970. Laos, 1958-59-60. Ecuador, 1960-63. The Dominican Republic, 1963. Bolivia, 1964-1971. Indonesia, 1965. Portugal, 1974-76. Jamaica, 1976-80, Chad, 1981-82, Grenada, 1983, Fiji, 1987, Nicaragua, 1981-90, Panama, 1989, Bulgaria, 1990, Yugoslavia, 1999-2000, Ecuador, 2000, Afghanistan, 2001, Venezuela, 2002, Iraq, 2003, Haiti, 2004, Libya, 2011. And there were other attempted CIA-U.S.-backed coups and revolutions that were not successful, including in Albania, 1949-53, East Germany in the 1950s, Costa Rica in the mid-1950s, Egypt in 57, Indonesia in 57-8, France in 65, Costa Rica in 1970-71, Angola in 75 in the 80s, Zaire in 1975, South Yemen in 1982-84, Suriname in 1982-84, Libya in the 1980s, Iraq in 1991, Somalia in 1993, and again in 2007, and Syria in 2012. That gives you an idea that we have been nonstop intervening in other countries of the world. And what is the total cost of this? Once again, if you supported Hillary Clinton, you supported the ticket of Barack Obama, but specifically Hillary Clinton, do you also take responsibility? Do you have any moral umbrage when it concerns how many people died under these people's specific orders and results of their interventions? Let me give you some examples. A 2015 study concluded that the United States directly responsible for killing over 20 million people in 37 nations since World War II. Indirectly, this figure is much higher, closer to 30 million. Where did these people die? The Korean War and the Vietnam War, 15 million deaths. Involvement in the Afghan-Soviet War, 1.8 million. In 2001, the Afghan War under Bush, 12,000 officially. Angola in 1997, 750,000 deaths. Hungary in 1956, 37,000. Laos, 1957-70. During almost every year, the CIA would support a coup to prevent Laos from having democratically elected governments because of the popularity of the leftist parties. Solution? Indiscriminate bombing. 580,000 bombing missions between 1964 and 73. Minimally 20,000 dead. In Haiti in 1959, 100,000 Haitians killed by the U.S.-supported dictator Duvalier. Indonesia, 1965, the United States supported Suharto, and military coup leads to between 500,000 and 1 million civilians killed for being accused of being communists, and later, with East Timor, total deaths about 3 million. In the Dominican Republic in 1956, President Johnson invades the country with U.S. Marines, 3,000 Dominicans killed. CIA Operation Phoenix massacred 20,000 suspected but never proven of being Viet Cong. In Cambodia, by the U.S. overthrowing Prince Suharnik to get Cambodia involved in the Vietnam War and putting the CIA puppet Lon Nol in power. Well, by the way, that's the same Lon Nol that we put into power, the CIA put into power, that would then create the Khmer Rouge responsible for killing, massacring, torturing 2.5 million of his own people. The United States has never apologized for supporting, empowering, financing, and protecting Lon Nol. In Chile, in the 1970s, Pinochet's regime of terror, anywhere from 3,000 murdered, but 30,000 disappeared, we must assume most murdered. El Salvador Civil War, 1981 and 82, 75,000 killed. And the U.S. spent $6 billion, that's billion dollars, on the right-wing factions to keep the struggle going in El Salvador. In Chad in 1982, the CIA supported the dictator, Habré, 40,000 murdered, 200,000 tortured. Oh, we also show them how to torture. We had a school for torture, assassination, and regime change, especially if you were a leftist regime, a populist regime, a democratic regime. We could not tolerate that. So we had the School of the Americas, where we brought people from around the world and showed them how to kill, torture, subvert, and false flag. Ongoing Iraq-Iran wars from 1980 to 88. The United States supported that war, supported Saddam Hussein, provided intelligence, weapons, and almost 1 million dead Iranians, 268,000 dead Iraqis. In Colombia, since 1986, U.S. involvement in the drug wars, 20,000 minimally killed for political reasons by U.S.-supported paramilitary gangs. And in the Israeli-Palestinian conflicts, U.S. is the primary weapons donor to Israel, tens of thousands killed. The Iraq War, 2003, 654,000 killed, according to Johns Hopkins, but others claim it's 1.5 million. And then you can look at Bill Clinton, 1990, in Somalia Civil War, from 1990 to 93, up to 1 million deaths. 350,000 of them starved to death. Somalia massacre occurred under the Clinton's watch. So if you're supporting Hillary Clinton, do you also support the starvation of men, women, and children? Because it happened, they're responsible. Under Clinton's first term, the Iraqi sanctions caused the death minimally of 560,000 children. And that's 4,000 young children under the age of five per month. And that's under the Clintons, where Madeleine Albright, when asked on 60 Minutes by Leslie Stahl, was it worth it? She said yes. So let me just be clear on this. To Michael Moore, to others who, with good intentions, have been critical of Donald Trump, I don't have a problem if you're criticizing Donald Trump. You and everyone else has a right to criticize whoever you want. But then the assumption is, and your statements are, and this glory feast of praise for Hillary Clinton, that she is the answer. What if it was one of your children? Do you support the death of over a half million children as being worth it? Because if you support her, you must also be responsible for what she has personally done. So if someone kills a half million children in one country, I would not put them high up on my list of people I would recommend. But you have. Do you own that? In 1992 to 95, the Bosnian War, completely unnecessary. Over 100,000 dead. That's Bill and Hillary Clinton. By the way, the head of Yugoslavia was later found in an extended, the most comprehensive court trial in history in Yugoslavia by the International Criminal Court, that he was innocent. 1994 in Rwanda, the Clintons stood by as 800,000 Tutsis were slaughtered. But some say that's an underestimate and is closer to 2 million. Who's a close friend of the Clintons? Who's received money from this person? The Clinton Foundation? Kagame. Kagame is a butcherer. Kagame is a genocidalist. Kagame is a maniac. And he was responsible for what went on. And he's an ally of the Clintons. And then 2009 in Honduras, thousands dead under Hillary Clinton. 2011, that's strictly Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton's destruction. According to Amnesty International, the actual number of deaths is unknown. But it's estimated 30,000 innocent civilians were killed. Over 2 million made homeless. The country is bankrupt. 50,000 were wounded with no treatment available. Violent deaths have continued within several thousands per year since the regime change. And what was really interesting, and this tells you a lot about the character of the Clintons, she went on television and cackled about, "We came, we saw he died," something like that. And he would die because he was sodomized with knives. So if you don't have a problem with that, I guess you won't have a problem with Hillary Clinton. But be aware, that was on her. And look at the terrorist hotbed since. and the Ukraine, mostly in the Donbass region, 9,100 believe to be a conservative figure because Ukrainian fascists, which the United States funds and supports, is misreporting actual count. It's probably closer to about 18,000 wounded and around 10,000 dead. And then, of course, we have the Yemen, where I started the program with 10,000 minimally dead. That number, 40,000 wounded, but millions suffering, over 26 million suffering from starvation and homelessness because we support the most vicious, vile, evil regime on the planet, the Saudi Arabians. I'm Gary Nall. Now let's go over and listen to what a man has to say on this very topic, and he will give you a different perspective because he was there. He was there in situations where he told the people, you give us your assets or you're going to die. Let's now hear from John Perkins, Confessions of an Economic Hitman.
We economic hitmen really have been the ones responsible for creating this first truly global empire. And we work many different ways. But perhaps the most common is that we will identify a country that has resources our corporations covet, like oil, and then arrange a huge loan to that country from the World Bank or one of its sister organizations. But the money never actually goes to the country. Instead, it goes to our big corporations to build infrastructure projects in that country, power plants, industrial parks, ports, things that benefit a few rich people in that country, in addition to our corporations, but really don't help the majority of the people at all. However, those people, the whole country is left holding a huge debt. It's such a big debt they can't repay it, and that's part of the plan, that they can't repay it. And so at some point, we economic hitmen go back to them and say, listen, you lost a lot of money, can't pay your debt, so sell your oil real cheap to our oil companies. Allow us to build a military base in your country or send troops in support of ours to someplace in the world like Iraq or vote with us on the next UN vote to have their electric utility company privatized and their water and sewage system privatized and sold to U.S. corporations or other multinational corporations. So there was a whole mushrooming thing, and it's so typical of the way the IMF and the World Bank work. They put a country in debt. It's such a big debt, it can't pay it. And then you offer to refinance that debt and pay even more interest. And you demand this quid pro quo, which you call a conditionality or good governance, which means basically that they've got to sell off their resources, including many of their social services, their utility companies, their school systems sometimes, their penal systems, their insurance systems to foreign corporations. So it's a double, triple, quadruple whammy. The precedent for economic hitmen really began back in the early 50s when democratically elected Mossadegh, who was elected in Iran, he was considered to be the hope for democracy in the Middle East and around the world. He was Time Magazine's Man of the Year. But one of the things that he'd run on and began to implement was the idea that foreign oil companies needed to pay the Iranian people a lot more for the oil that they were taking out of Iran. The Iranian people should benefit from their own oil. Strange policy. We didn't like that, of course. But we were afraid to do what we normally were doing, which was to send in the military. Instead, we sent in one CIA agent, Kermit Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt's relative. And Kermit went in with a few million dollars and was very, very effective and efficient. And in a short amount of time, he managed to get Mossadegh overthrown and brought in the Shah of Iran to replace him, who always was favorable to oil. And it was extremely effective.
Mobs overflow Tehran. Army officers shout that Mossadegh has surrendered and his regime as virtual dictator of Iran is ended. Pictures of the Shah are paraded through the streets as sentiment reverses. The Shah is welcomed home.
So back here in the United States, in Washington, people looked around and said, wow, that was easy and cheap. So this established a whole new way of manipulating countries, of creating empire. The only problem with Roosevelt was that he was a card-carrying CIA agent, and had he been caught, the ramifications could have been pretty serious. So very quickly at that point, the decision was made to use private consultants to channel the money through the World Bank or the IMF or one of the other such agencies to bring in people like me who worked for private companies. So that if we got caught, there would be no governmental ramifications. When Arbenz became president of Guatemala, the country was very much under the thumbs of United Fruit Company, the big international corporations. And Arbenz ran on the ticket that said, you know, we want to get the land back to the people. And once he took power, he was implementing policies that would do exactly that, give the land rights back to the people. United Fruit didn't like that very much. And so they hired a public relations firm, launched a huge campaign in the United States to convince the United States, people, the citizens of the United States, and the press of the United States, and the Congress of the United States, that Arbenz was a Soviet puppet, and that if we allowed him to stay in power, the Soviets would have a foothold in this hemisphere. And that, at that point in time, was a huge fear on everybody's mind, the Red Terror, the Communist Terror. And so, to make a long story short, out of this public relations campaign came a commitment on the part of the CIA and the military to take this man out. And in fact, we did. We sent in planes, we sent in soldiers, we sent in jackals, we sent everything in to take him out, and did take him out. And as soon as he was removed from office, the new guy that took over after him basically reinstated everything to the big international corporations, including United Fruit. Ecuador, for many, many years, had been ruled by pro-U.S. dictators, often relatively brutal. Then it was decided that they were going to have a truly democratic election. Jaime Roldós ran for office. And his main goal, he said, as president, would be to make sure that Ecuador's resources were used to help the people. And he won, overwhelming, by more votes than anybody had ever won anything in Ecuador. And he began to implement these policies to make sure that the profits from oil went to help the people. Well, we didn't like that in the United States. I was sent down as one of several economic hitmen to change Roldós, to corrupt him, to bring him around, to let him know, you know, okay, you know, you can get very rich, you and your family, if you play our game, but if you continue to try to keep these policies you've promised, you're going to go. He wouldn't listen. He was assassinated. As soon as the plane crashed, the whole area was cordoned off. The only people allowed in were the U.S. military from a nearby base and some of the Ecuadorian military. When an investigation was launched, two of the key witnesses died in car accidents before they had a chance to testify. A lot of very, very strange things that went on around the assassination of Jaime Roldós. I, like most people who've really looked at this case, had absolutely no doubt that it was an assassination. And, of course, in my position as an economic hitman, I was always expecting something to happen to Jaime, whether it be a coup or assassination. I wasn't sure, but that he would be taken down because he was not being corrupted. He would not allow himself to be corrupted the way we wanted to corrupt him. Omar Torrijos, president of Panama, was, you know, one of my favorite people. I really, really liked him. He was very charismatic. He was a guy who really wanted to help his country. And when I tried to bribe him or corrupt him, he said, look, John, he called me Juanito. He said, look, Juanito, I don't need the money. What I really need is for my country to be treated fairly. I need for the United States to repay the debts that you owe my people for all the destruction you've done here. I need to be in a position where I can help other Latin American countries win their independence and be free of this terrible presence from the north that you people are exploiting us so badly. I need to have the Panama Canal back in the hands of the Panamanian people. That's what I want. And so, leave me alone. Don't try to bribe me. It was 1981. And in May, Jaime Roldós was assassinated. And Omar was very aware of this. Torrijos got his family together and he said, I'm probably next. But it's okay, because I've done what I came here to do. I've renegotiated the canal. The canal will now be in our hands. He just finished negotiating the treaty with Jimmy Carter. In June of that same year, just a couple of months later, he also went down in an airplane crash which there's no question was executed by CIA-sponsored jackals. Tremendous amount of evidence that one of Torrijos' security guards handed him at the last moment as he was getting on the plane, a tape recorder, a small tape recorder, that contained a bomb. It is interesting to me how this system has continued pretty much the same way for years and years and years, except the economic hitmen have got better and better and better. Then we come up with, very recently, what happened in Venezuela in 1998, Hugo Chavez gets elected president, following a long line of presidents who had been very corrupt and basically destroyed the economy of the country. And Chavez was elected amidst all that. Chavez stood up to the United States, and he's done it primarily demanding that Venezuelan oil be used to help the Venezuelan people. Well, we didn't like that in the United States. So in 2002, the coup was staged, which is no question in my mind, or most other people's minds, that the CIA was behind that coup. The way that that coup was fomented was very reflective of what Kermit Roosevelt had done in Iran, of paying people to go out into the streets to riot, to protest, to say this Chavez is very unpopular. You know, if you can get a few thousand people to do that, television can make it look like it's the whole country, and things start to mushroom. Except in the case of Chavez, he was smart enough, and the people were so strongly behind him that they overcame it, which was a phenomenal moment in the history of Latin America. Iraq actually is a perfect example of the way the whole system works. So we economic hitmen are the first line of defense. We go in and we try to corrupt governments and get them to accept these huge loans, which we then use as leverage to basically own them. If we fail, as I failed in Panama with Omar Torrijos and in Ecuador with Jaime Roldós, men who refused to be corrupted, then the second line of defense is we send in the jackals. And the jackals either overthrow governments or they assassinate. And once that happens, when a new government comes in, boy, it's going to toe the line because the new president knows what will happen if he doesn't. In the case of Iraq, both of those things failed. Economic hitmen were not able to get through to Saddam Hussein. We tried very hard. We tried to get him to accept a deal very similar to what the House of Saud had accepted in Saudi Arabia, but he wouldn't accept it. And so the jackals went in to take him out. They couldn't do it. His security was very good. After all, he had one time worked for the CIA. He'd been hired to assassinate a former president of Iraq and failed, but he knew the system. So in 91, we sent in the troops, and we take out the Iraqi military. So we assume at that point that Saddam Hussein is going to come around. We could have taken him out, of course, at that time, but we didn't want him. He's the kind of strong man we like. He controls his people. We thought he could control the Kurds and keep the Iranians in their border and keep pumping oil for us. And that once we took out his military, now he's going to come around. So the economic hitmen go back in the 90s without success. If they'd had success, he'd still be running the country. We'd be selling him all the fighter jets he wants and everything else he wants. But they couldn't. They didn't have success. The jackals couldn't take him out again. So we sent the military in once again, and this time we did the complete job and took him out, and in the process created for ourselves some very, very lucrative construction deals. We had to reconstruct a country that we'd essentially destroyed, which is a pretty good deal if you own construction companies, big ones. So, you know, Iraq shows the three stages. The economic hitmen failed there. The jackals failed there. And as a final measure, the military goes in. And in that way, we've really created an empire, but we've done it very, very subtly. It's clandestine. All the empires of the past were built on the military. And everybody knew they were building them. So the British knew they were building them. The French, the Germans, the Romans, the Greeks. And they were proud of it, and they always had some excuse, like spreading civilization, spreading some religion, something like that. But they knew they were doing it. We don't. The majority of the people in the United States have no idea that we're living off the benefits of a clandestine empire, that today there's more slavery in the world than ever before. And then you have to ask yourself, well, if it's an empire, then who's the emperor? obviously, our presidents of the United States are not emperors. An emperor is someone who's not elected, doesn't serve a limited term, and doesn't report to anyone, essentially. So you can't classify our presidents that way. But we do have what I consider to be the equivalent of the emperor, and it's what I call the corporatocracy. The corporatocracy is this group of individuals who run our biggest corporations, and they really act as the emperor of this empire. They control our media, either through direct ownership or advertising. They control most of our politicians because they finance their campaigns, either through their corporations or through personal contributions that come out of the corporations. They're not elected, and they don't serve a limited term, they don't report to anybody. And at the very top of the corporatocracy, you really can't tell whether a person's working for a private corporation or the government because they're always moving back and forth. So, you know, you've got a guy who one moment is the president of a big construction company like Halliburton, and the next moment he's vice president of the United States, or the president who is in the oil business. And this is true whether you've got Democrats or Republicans in the office. You have them moving back and forth through the revolving door. And in a way, our government is invisible a lot of the time, and its policies are carried out by our corporations on one level or another. And then again, the policies of the government are basically forged by the corporatocracy and then presented to the government. They become government policy. So it's an incredibly cozy relationship. This isn't a conspiracy theory type of thing. These people don't have to get together and plot to do things. They all basically work under one primary assumption, and that is that they must maximize profits regardless of the social and environmental costs.
This process of manipulation by the corporatocracy through the use of debt, bribery, and political overthrow is called globalization. Just as the Federal Reserve keeps the American public in a position of indentured servitude through perpetual debt, inflation, and interest, the World Bank and IMF serve this role on a global scale. The basic scam is simple. Put a country in debt, either by its own indiscretion or through corrupting the leader of that country. Then impose conditionalities or structural adjustment policies, often consisting of the following. Currency devaluation. When the value of a currency drops, so does everything valued in it. This makes indigenous resources available to predator countries at a fraction of their worth. Large funding cuts for social programs. These usually include education and healthcare, compromising the well-being and integrity of the society, leaving the public vulnerable to exploitation. Privatization of state-owned enterprises. This means that socially important systems can be purchased and regulated by foreign corporations for profit. For example, in 1999, the World Bank insisted that the Bolivian government sell the public water system of its third largest city to a subsidy of the U.S. corporation Bechtel. As soon as this occurred, water bills for the already impoverished local residents skyrocketed. It wasn't until after a full-blown revolt by the people that the Bechtel contract was nullified. Then there's trade liberalization, or the opening up of the economy through removing any restrictions on foreign trade. This allows for a number of abusive economic manifestations, such as transnational corporations bringing in their own mass-produced products, undercutting the indigenous production and ruining local economies. An example is Jamaica, which, after accepting loans and conditionalities from the World Bank, lost its largest cash crop markets due to competition with Western imports. Today, countless farmers are out of work, for they are unable to compete with the large corporations. Another variation is the creation of numerous seemingly unnoticed, unregulated, inhumane sweatshop factories, which take advantage of the imposed economic hardship. Additionally, due to production deregulation, environmental destruction is perpetual, as a country's resources are often exploited by the indifferent corporations while outputting large amounts of deliberate pollution.
The largest environmental lawsuit in the history of the world today is being brought on behalf of 30,000 Ecuadorian Amazonian people against Texaco, which is now owned by Chevron, so today it's against Chevron, but for activities conducted by Texaco. Estimated to be more than 18 times what the Exxon Valdez dumped into the coast of Alaska in the case of Ecuador.
This is just a little background on why we have intervened in over 81 countries' elections. It's all about economic self-interest. And the more that the public knows about how we actually conduct business and what we actually do to countries that are democratically elected, do not want their natural resources exploited, and the dangers that those running the countries risk is important. Otherwise, it will not stop. And it doesn't matter who's in power. For the last 32 years, virtually all U.S. regimes, from Reagan and George Bush Sr., then Bill Clinton, George Bush Jr., Obama, and I'm sure it will also continue with Trump, is to look at the hegemony that the United States exercises as if somehow we are entitled to our imperial overreach. Well, it is for we the people to say no more. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour.
Far too many of you die.